You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Marcus. How are you going? Are you there?
Yes.
Awesome. We've got Marcus Jones from AUT on the line today. We've got some exciting stuff coming up. So how have you been? How's home life treating you?
Well, I actually made it to work yesterday, which was very exciting, but home again today. Slowly transferring back to the world of the living.
Yeah, well, it's the first week back of uni as well, so I assume that we've got some cool on-campus stories coming up, hopefully.
Yes.
Does it feel good to be staring at people's blank faces rather than blank screens now?
It absolutely does, yeah.
We've got some really cool stuff on Dear Science today. First of all, the animal melting pot created by climate change could possibly lead to new disease outbreaks, which is always concerning, especially during a pandemic where any mention of disease kind of sends people into a bit of a panic, a bit of a frenzy. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, so this is a sort of a conflagration of two of our favorite topics, really, climate change and viruses. So obviously Earth is warming, and one of the consequences of Earth's warming climate is that it is expected to change the habitat of many animal species. So when habitats change, the species tend to move, and species on the move will tend to mingle with other species that maybe they've never encountered before, and all of these sort of interminglings will allow the various animals to exchange viruses, which could, people predict, spark new disease outbreaks in many wildlife populations, and potentially in humans as well. So by about 2070, so about 50 years from now, assuming the most conservative warming scenario, there'll be at least about 15,000 new cross-species transmissions involving more than 3,000 mammalian species. And that's according to modeling by a team at Georgetown University in the US. And that the modelers calculate that there are about 21 million possible pairings of mammalian species, and only 7% of these duos currently share geographic range. So there's tremendous opportunity for new encounters.
Well, yeah, because
and so this team
animals,
wanted to know.
Yeah, they don't tend to interact, do they? These animals, they're kind of confined to most of their own geographical niches, aren't they?
That's right, and they're confined to regions where climate suits them. Mm. And the team wanted to know that under various climate change scenarios, from temperature increases of 2 to up to 4 degrees Celsius. How that would affect the mammals who inhabit those regions and mingle in those regions, and which first encounters might lead to viral exchanges. Only about 6% of the possible pairs harbor viruses from the same family, suggesting those could swap pathogens at a future encounter. Mm. And so some of the findings were quite surprising. So when you think, okay, well, the planet's going to warm, so maybe the species that are near the equator might move north or south towards the poles. But the model showed that a lot of mixing occurs much earlier, because the species will actually first move to habitats at higher or lower altitudes. So one way of cooling down, obviously, is go up. Bats, for instance, which make up about 20% of all the mammals, will have a really big sort of outsized impact on mixing, because their ability to fly, obviously, allows even non-migratory species to travel hundreds of kilometers in a lifetime, which is far more mobile than a small mammal, a mouse or something like that.
So would you expect that there's a bigger risk from these animals that can fly, and in terms of kind of spreading potential diseases and cross-mixing?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, at species such as bats, so the 20% of all the mammals on this planet are bats. So they've got a tremendous potential, and we know the bats are linked with, potentially, at least allegedly, unless you believe the conspiracy theories, the bats were linked with the current COVID outbreak. So I think that's tremendously important. Now, there's a concrete example they talk about. The team did a case study of Ebola virus in Zaire, and they predicted 13 possible mammalian hosts based on what we know about the virus. Adding in the changing climate and how far mammals can roam, they estimate that the least dramatic climate change scenario could cause the virus to be involved in more than 2,000 first encounters between two species, of which nearly 100 might lead to a jump from one species to another.
Oh my God.
And those leaps could cause deaths in some of the species and some of these species, but also lead to Ebola infections in humans in the Horn of Africa, where the disease has never ever been seen before. And Ebola is obviously extremely scary. So this is something that we really need to think about.
Yeah, and I think I've just never, and I'm sure a lot of you, unless you're very much into animals and I guess epidemiology, it's never something that I've thought about either.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think that the recent COVID outbreak or current COVID outbreak has really highlighted this. I mean, if it is true that it was linked to bats and I think pangolins, then you know, if these species move to different regions, there could be other viruses that could also transfer.
We'll move on to our second topic for today, which is a balloon which has detected signs of a sound tunnel. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Alan talked about helium in kids' birthday balloons. So there's a helium shortage right now as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war. But now that we had a few texts in saying that balloons are pretty much awful in any scenario, but this one seems to be a little bit more useful. So it's detected a sound tunnel in the sky. Tell us about that.
Okay, so I can't really comment on the helium that was used to fly these balloons, but it may be a more useful application of helium than you know, your kid's birthday. Although saying that, I do have a helium balloon floating over my head for my son 6, which was last week. So in the 1940s, the scientists discovered. So we're going to go down first. In the 1940s, scientists discovered about a kilometer under the sea, there is something called a sound tunnel that carries the cries of whales and submarines and other ship noise and things like that over vast distances. And they call this a sound fixing and ranging channel, SOFAR channel. And they've suspected that a similar type of sort of sound conduit exists in the atmosphere, but not many people have really bothered to look for it, apart from an operation in the Cold War that didn't quite succeed. Now, recently, listening to distant rocket launches with solar-powered balloons, they've actually seems to have detected hints of such an aerial sound channel. Although it doesn't seem to function as simply or maybe as reliably as the ocean channel. And it could, although if it is confirmed, it could pave the way for a network of aerial receivers that could help researchers detect remote explosions from volcanoes, for instance, from bombs, from other very loud sources that emit maybe infrasound, very low frequency sound waves, which we wouldn't normally hear.
Wow, that's cool. New?
It is. It's actually really quite interesting. So in the ocean, this channel, as they call it, the SOFAR channel, it's bounded by layers of warmer water, which is lighter, above, and cooler, denser water below. And the sound waves, which travel more slowly at this depth, get trapped inside this channel, bouncing off the surrounding layers. So it's like a bowling ball guided by bumpers. And so researchers rely on this channel to monitor earthquakes under the seafloor and even to measure ocean temperatures from global warming.
That's always important to know.
Yeah, absolutely. and it was postulated in the 40s that there could be an analogous layer in the sky. So around about 10, between about 10 and 20 kilometers up is a layer called the tropopause, which is the boundary between the troposphere, which is the lowest layer of the atmosphere where we are and where weather occurs, and the stratosphere, which is above. And just like the channel under the water, the tropopause represents a cold region where sound waves should travel more slowly and much further as a result. And so an acoustic wave guide, sort of a guide for the sound waves in the atmosphere, they thought in the 40s could help the U.S. military to detect, for example, nuclear weapons testing in the Soviet Union. But they tried to find it, but the instruments often malfunctioned in high winds and at that altitude. And an interesting note, in 1947, debris from one of the balloons crashed just outside of Roswell, New Mexico, and that sparked one of the most famous UFO conspiracy theories in history, which was kept secret for about 50 years until it was declassified in the 90s.
Just because of that, the instrument that crashed.
The instrument, yes. They were trying to find this sound channel in the atmosphere, but they caused a UFO conspiracy theory that lasted about 60 years instead.
Imagine that being a lasting legacy. What would you do?
Well, yes, that's not an unexpected legacy, yeah. but anyway, so bringing us up to date, in last year, actually, in April last year, a bunch of scientists at Sandia National Labs in New Mexico launched a balloon at sunrise, and they timed the flight to coincide with the launch of Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket, which was taking off about 400 kilometers away in Texas. Floating within the channel, the balloon picked up three clear signals from the rocket, one when it launched and two more when it ascended and descended through the tropopause. And so they revealed this at a meeting last week in America, and this observation marks the first verified infrasound detection of a distant airborne source with this airborne receiver. So this is pointing to the existence of such a sound channel in the atmosphere, and we could make use of this in future, especially when you remember just a few months ago we had this eruption in Tonga. The closest ground-based detectors were more than 750 kilometers away, but having a balloon array in place, so balloons that could listen at that altitude, they could have helped determine the location, time, and size of those of that incident much more quickly.
There's incredible implications for people who are constantly at risk of volcanic eruptions and earthquakes and that kind of thing.
Just absolutely,
kind of give you a jump on evacuations.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we'll move on to our final topic for today. This one's kind of a bummer, as usual. Ozone destroying chemicals are on the rise, even though we've been trying to avoid this. So I assume this is CFCs, is it? The ones that are emitted from fridges?
Yes, it's CFCs. So remember, before global warming, before COVID, we had an ozone layer. We actually had an ozone hole at one point. And in the 80s, the world got together and decided they were going to do something about it. And they did something about it, which in the last few decades have led to a gradual decline of these CFCs, which are chlorofluorocarbons, so chemicals containing fluorine and chlorine, in the atmosphere. But levels of a particular ozone-destroying chemical are starting mysteriously to rise. And this is despite all these efforts to crack down on CFCs. And there's an uptick in an airborne chemical called HCFC-141B, which is not that an exciting name, but it comes even though decline in this production, or at least reported production, has declined steadily since 2012. And so scientists are a bit stumped, really, about where it's coming from. And this discovery underscores a challenge of getting rid of these chemicals, which were once very widely used. And they they can linger in appliances, in refrigerators, and other cooling devices for many, many decades. And it also shows how big gaps in our network of sensors make it very, very hard to pinpoint sources of those chemicals. So where is this coming from? It's really hard to say. Now, the chemical itself is used chiefly to make the foam insulation for appliances such as refrigerators, and it's part of this family of chemicals that were blamed for eating away at this layer of ozone in the stratosphere, about 20 kilometers up.
It seems to me that CFCs have been a problem for quite a while, and even though we've got these laws in place to kind of limit that, it just doesn't seem to be working. Is that people kind of just not thinking the rules apply to them, or just blatant disregard?
Well, in the 80s, a major international agreement was signed by just about every country in the world, and CFC production pretty much ground to a halt. Mm. And that's led to this decline of CFCs in the atmosphere. They last a long time, so the decline has been slow. They don't go away quickly. But if we're not making any more, then they should not be increasing. Now, in 2018, researchers found a different CFC chemical had been rising since about 2012, and a panel concluded that was likely due to illicit production, probably in eastern China, but it wasn't clear exactly where. This current chemical, HCFC-141B, should also be declining. It started being phased out in 2013, and it was going to be completely banned in 2030, and it's being replaced by a group of chemicals that don't damage the ozone layer at all, but scientists say that these levels are rising, and so it's not clear exactly where it's coming from. The situation seems to be a bit murkier than that previous chemical, the previous CFC chemical, which they thought was coming from China. There's some sensors in South Korea, for instance, suggest the problem isn't originating in eastern China. It doesn't seem to be coming from somewhere in the northern hemisphere, because levels have been rising fast. It does seem to be coming from somewhere in the northern hemisphere, because levels have been rising faster there than in the southern hemisphere. But one possibility is that maybe it's being manufactured illicitly somewhere in the world, but maybe the blip could also temporarily be due to aging appliances being thrown out, and as the foam breaks down, it releases the gas. Mm. But it just shows that, these global problems are very complex and they take a long time to correct. So this is now, 30 or 40 years that the world has been trying to fight and lower the CFCs chemicals. And to a very pretty big degree, they've had a lot of success. The ozone hole has gotten a lot smaller.
I'm kind of hoping...
it's still an ongoing issue.
I'm more optimistic that people just aren't as, I guess, shit. And hopefully they're just more just negligent, maybe. But I guess it's just something we'll just have to keep an eye on in the coming years.
Yes, it could be a completely unexpected source. So it could be just, just decomposing refrigerators leaking out this gas.
One of the great science mysteries of our time. So, if you're a scientist out there and you're wanting to get your name on something, maybe solve the mystery of the rising CFCs. That brings us to the end of Dear Science for another week. Thank you very much to Marcus for calling in. He has let me know that he's been moving today, so wish him all the best with his move, especially with his characteristic kids. Classic.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.